The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention. For the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please.
Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. And the order of their appearance, they are docket number 070945, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department versus the Sawyer Trust from Donley County and the 7th Court of Appeals District. Docket number 080799, State Farm Lloyds and Aaron Strachan versus Wanda M. Page from Johnson County and the 10th Court of Appeals District. And docket number 090387, Carol Severance versus Jerry Patterson, Commissioner of the Texas General Land Office, Greg Abbott, Attorney General for the State of Texas, and Kurt Sistrunk, District Attorney for the County of Galveston, Texas. And that is a certified question from the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. I will not be sitting in the final cause and will be sitting in all in the other two, but we'll have to miss the second argument. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between the arguments. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in the first cause, 070945, Texas Parks and Wildlife Department versus the Sawyer Trust.
May it please the court. Mr. Monson will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. Heinrich mandates dismissal of the declaratory judgment portion of this lawsuit because it was brought against an entity, not against an official. And the case should not be remanded for repleting against an official because that would in essence allow a different lawsuit against a different defendant based on a different legal theory, which leaves the only basis of jurisdiction over a suit against the department as the trust's purported takings claim. That the trust's pleadings fail to state a valid takings claim and therefore fail to invoke an exception to immunity from suit for two reasons. First, their pleadings are in substance an attempt to assert title to property in a lawsuit brought against a state entity, and that lawsuit is barred by State versus Lane. And second, the remedy they seek is injunctive relief, not the money damages that are contemplated by Article 1, Section 17, or the Fifth Amendment. Moreover, that takings claim cannot be remanded for repleting, because the uncontroverted evidence before the trial court at the time that it ruled affirmatively negates any potential alternative takings claim. I'd like to address Heinrich and that remand issue quickly before turning to the meat of the takings issue.
Is it your position that Heinrich forecloses all declaratory relief, that we should read it that broadly against a governmental agency?
We think that Heinrich recognizes the longstanding principle that declaratory relief is not available against state entities because the Act does not waive the entity's immunity from suit. However, to be clear, the legislature has provided in particular circumstances, such as suits brought by littoral property owners, the declaratory judgment relief is available against a state entity just for specific limited subject matters. But none of those are at issue here. This isn't a littoral property rights case. And Heinrich makes clear that to get a UDJA claim, you have to sue an official. The facial failure to plead a claim against an official defeats the trust.
Why, if they amended to name an official, mm-hmm. then why wouldn't they have a viable claim at that point, if we ask that they replead?
They wouldn't have and that's a little bit different from the takings claim.
Right, I understand.
But under Lane or under the cognate federal jurisprudence, they would have to bring essentially a claim in ejectment, stating that there wasn't any legal basis for an official's assertion of control or entry onto the property. And the legal question there, it's our submission, would be different in kind from the question of navigability, which is the substance of both their deck action and their takings claim.
But wouldn't navigability answer the question?
It would, but like so many questions that are barred by sovereign immunity, that's a question the courts have the capacity to answer, but it would be inappropriate to address in a lawsuit where a state entity is the defendant.
But, I mean, wouldn't it answer the question of whether the official acted ultra vires?
It would be one way of answering that question, but it's not the exclusive means of answering the question. And I think this goes to basically the point that's raised in IT Davy and in the federal cases involving the United States in cases like Larson and Malone, which are discussed in the history of the Quiet Title Act, which is that if the remedy that the plaintiff seeks in one of these lawsuits against an official is going to run against the government in such a way that it's going to bind the government, then the lawsuit is barred by immunity. IT Davy is the perfect example. The court acknowledged, yes, there exists this category of ultra vires claims against state officials. You've alleged that it violates state law for an official to breach a contract. But we don't have to answer that knotty, difficult question, because the sum and substance of the relief that you request is money damages against the state, which means that, in effect, you haven't pleaded an ultra vires claim at all. The key is whether, and State versus Lane makes this clear, the key is whether the judgment that is sought would bind the state and determine the state's ownership of property or control state action. And if it does, the lawsuit is barred.
Well, wouldn't the judgment in Heinrich bind the government?
It does bind the government, but as Heinrich recognized in making the official entity distinction, the substantive analysis that you have to go through to isolate the official as an appropriate defendant ensures that all that the injunction will do is force the official to follow the law and act within the scope of his authority.
But how is that any different here?
It's different here, for example, because
if an individual officer was named.
If an individual officer was named, you still couldn't have the lawsuit over navigability in the stream bed, because the substance of that lawsuit would determine the state's title to the minerals in and underneath the entire course of the Salt Fork of the Red River. There's no way to resolve that legal question without asking the same question that you'd have to ask in a suit against the entity to determine title.
And because, but in Heinrich, the answer was going to determine the plaintiff's benefits, right?
Well, I think that Heinrich is a little bit different, and because in that case there was a contested fact question as to what the benefits were supposed to be. Everyone agreed that the law precluded the board from retroactively changing Mrs. Heinrich's benefits. So if it were in fact true that her benefits had been one thing or the other, a change in them would have been an ultra vires act, and so the court remanded for a determination of what the scope of her benefits was in the first place.
But if here official had just undertaken to conserve as much property for the state as possible and apply a definition of navigability that the law shouldn't apply, wouldn't that still, isn't that the same kind of question that was involved in Heinrich?
It is, but I submit that the question is whether the official acted outside of their statutory authority.
How will we know if we don't know whether it's navigable or not?
Well, we know at least one predicate issue, which is that the department and its officials have authority to assert the state's title to minerals that are in navigable stream beds as a general matter. So that's the first hurdle, whether there's statutory authority to do the type of thing that's being done. The next question is whether there's any reasonable basis for officials to take the action that they've undertaken. You know, and I think this aspect of the law has become a little bit confusing because of the dictum in State versus Lane suggesting that it's appropriate to determine title in the suit against the official and kind of sidestepping Lane's broad rule barring trespass to try title claims. We'd submit that concept has already been limited by Heinrich and by Casolo or Kasiaglu, however you want to say it, because the limitation on Epperson that the court recognized that W.D. Hayden versus Dodgen hadn't narrowed, Casolo narrows that exception to the United States versus Lee principle.
Are you ever entitled to a judicial determination of navigability or not? Is that just something that is immune from court action altogether?
Well, we are immune. The state is immune from suits to determine navigability as a defendant. That doesn't mean the state can't initiate a lawsuit, and it doesn't mean that the legislature can't create a waiver of immunity from suit specific to the question, as it did in the Brainerd case.
But it has, that's very rare.
It's not as rare as all that, Your Honor. I mean, if it's a real problem, the legislature will grant the waiver. This past session, the legislature has granted a permission to sue the Railroad Commission in a major oil and gas case. It isn't the case that it never happens.
Has there been one since Brainerd?
Well, for navigability, not navigability specifically, but that doesn't mean that the legislature hasn't considered or rejected applications for these trespass to tri-title suits, and in some we'd say that the real core of this case is the legislature's prerogative to decide how the state's title is going to be determined in the first place. Legislature knows how to issue specific permission over a specific controversy. Did that in Brainerd. Legislature knows how to waive immunity for a category of property claims that involve an adversarial claim against the state based on natural features of property. It did that for littoral property owners. And the legislature, moreover, I think this is a somewhat unique fact, and I'd like to discuss it, has the ability to resolve some property disputes by legislative action without letting them go to the courts at all. The small bill itself is an example of when the legislature can exercise its prerogative to change the background common law rules to resolve this kind of a systemic property law question. The legislature can and has chosen to allow some of these lawsuits to go forward and be decided in the courts. Its decision not to allow this type of lawsuit to proceed should be respected.
What if they do, as there's a suggestion in some of the briefs, and take the trust just takes the sand and gravel out and sells it, and the state then says that's wrong. They either sue them or they charge them with the crime. Theft.
Mm-hmm.
So what then? Does the trust at that point in time have the right to have determination made?
Absolutely. And in fact, that's how State versus Bradford and Hoofs versus Short worked. And that is one of the options that this court's precedent allows.
Has the department taken a position on the merits of this case outside the lawsuit? I mean, have you advised the respondent that you do or do not think that the respondent owns the sand and gravel?
Outside of the lawsuit, not to my knowledge, although I can double check and make sure. It's my understanding that this lawsuit was brought prospectively based on the trust's assertion of title to the entire parcel, and that they claim that there's no gravel that belongs to the state on that parcel as a prospective matter. Our pleading said, well, we don't know the status of your parcel. You know, please. We filed a special exception saying, please replead with more specificity. In the course of the plea of jurisdiction hearing, the trial court asked us to send somebody out to go and look at the river and physically inspect it. And it's the department's position that the submission of that letter in response to the trial court's request is an assertion of the department's control over the gravel in the stream bed on the state's behalf.
Oh, so you have taken a position there?
Yes. Our letter to the trial court takes the position that this is a navigable stream, which a fortiori means that the gravel belongs to the state. But to turn to the takings claim, at least briefly, and talk about why this isn't a takings claim. So the only real question is whether you can go back against the official. This isn't a takings claim because the real substance of the plaintiff's lawsuit, even in their First Amendment petition, is that they own the parcel of property and therefore they can mine the gravel on it. That the substance of that claim has to do with title to these minerals, this gravel that is on the property. That means that they've put in issue a question involving title to real property. That means that this is a suit for land within the scope of the broad rule set out in Lane. And that means that because they have sued the department, their suit is barred by sovereign immunity.
Can they reform their suit, though, to assert an ultra-virus claim?
Neither do assert an ultra-virus claim nor a takings claim, Justice Guzman. And I'd like to talk a little bit about what the uncontroverted evidence before the trial court showed. And I'd like to direct the court's attention to the department's letter, which is on page 15 of volume 1 of the clerk's record. It tells us a couple important things. One, this is a named river that people know about. It is a mile down from a major private dam that is a regulated water segment with regulated water rights under the TCEQ. Under the original survey notes, when the parcels were laid out, it was navigable because it was more than 30 feet wide from the mouth up along its course. And at least one place, measuring to an island in the middle of the stream, bed and banks, not to the other side, the river is at least 330 feet long, just in, at one place in the plaintiff's property.
Through their property, you maintain it's navigable.
Yes, although to be clear, one of the reasons that this would be an improper suit, even if it were brought as an ultra-vires claim, is that determining the navigability of this part of the river would determine navigability on other parts of the river as well, because navigability is based on the average width of the river from the mouth up. So this is not merely a situation in which the resolving the question of navigability would establish that the official had acted ultra vires. It would also adjudicate the state's title to the minerals in and under the beds and banks of the river on other properties as well.
Okay, so your position is that it's pretty clear in this case, as say as a matter of law, that it is a navigable stream.
Yes.
What about a case that's not so clear? In that case, would it be your position that the landowner wouldn't have any way, or nobody would have any way of determining whether they could mine that gravel or not without subjecting themselves to criminal liability?
Well, I don't think that's true. They could call the department and ask them to come out and tell them whether they think the stream's navigable.
But they'd have to accept that determination?
If they don't agree with the determination, and I think that if you look at their affidavits, it's clear that they can't actually controvert navigability. They're entitled to go to the legislature and ask for permission to challenge that determination.
That would be the only way.
That would be the only way. Or to commence mining, as Justice Johnson suggested, and await potential prosecution. I see my time is up, and if the court has any other questions about the record.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Sheets will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to start where counsel left off and work backwards. This so-called controverted evidence that counsel talks about is a letter from a state official who went out and looked, did not do a gradient boundary survey as Oklahoma versus Texas designed in the early 1920s, not like done in Brainerd, where the elements are set out, not like Model versus Boyd, or any other case in the tradition of river survey. His determination of navigability was going out and looking at the pasture.
But we don't even reach that question until we decide the immunity issue.
Yes.
And my question is, it seems like all these paths lead to title. Why isn't this essentially a trespassatory title claim, however it might be pled?
Let me try to answer that this way. I think we've got a confluence here of some competing types of well-established theories, and when they flow together, as the state would like to have you do in this case, it creates kind of a toxic mix or a bad gumbo if you've spent any time in New Orleans. But because you've got what many consider to be esoteric property concepts over here on gradient boundary surveying. And that methodology is what determines navigability. That was not done in this case. Then you have the notion of sovereign immunity. Then you have private property rights of the individual. And then you have this trespass to try title juxtaposition with boundary dispute cases. and historically. And then the other prong is the question of navigability, which our jurisprudence says navigability is a law question for a judge.
Well, so is a money damage claim a question for a judge, but the government's immune from those types of claims. So the fact that, that courts decide navigability really doesn't answer the sovereign immunity question.
Well, but I believe that it is the threshold factual inquiry which the property owner is entitled to have underlined. And it's our belief that the recent amendment to the Declaratory Judgment Act removes the Martin versus Ammerman problem of submitting a boundary dispute to declaratory judgment, even if the state's involved, and the threshold factual inquiry is navigability that must be established by possibly a gradient boundary survey from the state's standpoint. So this is a takings case.
But if we don't know who owns it, how can it be a takings case?
Well,
that's the assumption is in a takings case that the trust owns it.
Right.
And isn't that the question we're here about? Because the person you contracted with said, "I don't want to buy it until you can show me that the state's not involved in this, or you have a permit, one or the other." So it really comes back, as Justice O'Neill suggested, all roads lead to title.
Well, Justice Johnson, please look at where our clients
come from.
Well,
I understand it's a difficult situation,
but our clients assumed, because they had farmed, ranch, and paid taxes on this section for over 100 years, that they owned it.
Was the river there before they had it 100 years ago?
The riverbed. Well, our view is there is no riverbed.
Understand.
On this pasture. There is now, if you get into the navigability cases, they talk about there needs to be sufficient water to feed livestock. They've gotten a river declared by the state on their property without even the water that ought to go with it to feed their cattle. Because Ben Thompson has said, looks like a river out here to me. Now, they were involved in a gravel contract, a lucrative gravel contract being proposed by Trinity Industries, the record shows. And Trinity indicated that Parks and Wildlife told them they needed a permit. Our clients responded, "No, we don't. We own it." So Trinity said, "You better be sure of that." So we filed this suit in Donnelly County for a declaratory judgment that there was no navigable stream on this property. In the record are four affidavits. We have affidavits from the owners that there's never been enough water there to satisfy the navigability issues, from a licensed state land surveyor who checked the records in Donnelly County and says there's never been a navigable stream noted in the records of Donnelly County. The general manager of Greenbelt Water Authority.
But again, you're arguing the merits of navigability, and the issue we're here to decide is whether we can reach that question.
Well, Your Honor, since it's a takings claim.
So let's talk about takings
claims.
Yes. How can you assert a takings claim unless you start with the premise that you own the property? So don't you have to prove title before you can bring a takings claim?
Well, it's undisputed in this record that the Sawyers own the section of land on which this alleged river sits. So, the question of whether there has been a damage, and as the court's aware, the Texas law with regard to takings is broader in its wording than the federal constitution. because it says if you take, damage, or destroy. And there's a very articulate description of the parameters of taking in the Steele case, a very detailed statement by Justice Pope as to the breadth of it.
Is there any question that under the Small Act you own the surface?
No question.
And the estate?
No question. No one has disputed that. So the
About the sand and gravel.
Right. So you start with the proposition that we own the land. And the question is, has something occurred where the state has damaged the value or taken that land? And for the state to casually, by suggestion, without doing a survey, say, yes, we own all the sand and gravel, that is a damage to the land that is unquestionably owned by the Sawyer Trust.
But if it's a navigable stream, the Sawyer Trust doesn't own it, right?
Well, but we contend that's circular. In other words, there's no doubt that we own the land. We say, Your Honor, tell us if it's navigable.
And the state has asserted an ownership interest.
The state says nobody can talk about it. You can't talk about it. You could sue Ben Thompson. And as this court said in Heinrich, really, when we say go sue the state official, nobody thinks that that's really not a suit against the state. It is a construct that's been used for a long, long time and fraught with some difficulties, particularly for the citizen landowner to try to figure out. And there's been a good bit of discussion in the cases as to how difficult and confusing this can become. This court in Heinrich indicates what is, I'm never sure if Westlaw printouts what page I'm really on, but this is page 10 of what I have. This court said, parsing categories of permissible relief in cases implicating immunity inevitably involves compromise. The law of remedies against governments and government officials is a vast and complex body of doctrine full of technical distinctions, fictional explanations, and contested compromises. So what we are saying is that this really is a takings case, and how the case got framed up, we went to the Donnelly County Court, said the state's trying to make us get a permit. Please tell us whether it's navigable or not. Pleaded the jurisdictions filed. As counsel indicated, the judge said, well, state, do you own this land or not? They said, we don't know yet. The court literally took a recess and said, let's go call the state of Texas. So went into the office, called for Ben Thompson, say, are y'all going to claim this or not? They said, we don't know. We ought to go look at it. So he goes out and looks and writes a letter suggesting that, yes, the state owns it. So it's at that point, right after he sends his letter, we amend and say, if they're claiming that, that's a taking. And we pled the Constitution, we pled the Federal Constitution, we pled Article 1, Section 17, we pled 42 U.S.C. 1983, and to have the notion that we hadn't pled a takings claim, we think is not right. So that's how we got where we are. We did not sue a state official because it's our contention that we have a takings. Now, I don't understand any of Parks and Wildlife's arguments that we're completely dead on this issue and can't amend.
Who
would you sue if you wanted to? What would you amend to say?
I suppose I'd amend to add a state official.
Is it your contention someone has violated the law? And if so, who?
Well, I'd submit that that's part of the problem with this construct, the way it's being articulated and why there's so much confusion in the cases. And what the state's arguing is, if we had sued Ben Thompson, for instance, on the front end, if he had just sent us a letter saying we're claiming we own the sand and gravel on this section, we could have sued him, and then we all know that the state would have acted as if we'd sued them, and we'd have had some sort of movement forward on that notion, and then we may or may not get any relief. What the state is saying now is that we went too far because we already know that the agency is going to stand behind Ben Thompson's letter and say, the agency's telling you that we own it, not just Mr. Thompson, so you can't even get into an ultra vires situation because it's got the state itself saying we own that property. So it becomes convoluted at that point. We say because, not because of our behavior, but because of the technicalities of this construct between suing the official and suing the state, when you really get to the same result.
What about the implications of all of this to the landowners up and down the stream bed? I mean, it seems there would be a determination for everyone just because of this one situation. Wouldn't that be...
If you get into these plains rivers, and from dealing with it in Brainerd and Reamer, and in this case I can tell you that when you get downstream of dams on prairie rivers, you have segments that have water in them due to the idiosyncratic nature of certain parts of the water flood.
Right, and that's my point. Why isn't there a state interest, an overriding state interest in that, making it consistent up and down, rather than a patchwork of state does own or does not own or whatnot?
Well, what I was trying to get to and not doing it very well was that the state's position in this case on the record is limited to that one section. And I'm saying that there are places on prairie rivers where you may have a few sections where there's never water running on it. And you can go a few miles downstream because of creeks and gullies in the water flood that will put water in the riverbed on those sections periodically so as to allow a gradient boundary survey to be properly done. And so I'm not convinced that the determination on the Sawyer section would necessarily or should necessarily bind everyone up and down the river, but this historical notion of once navigable, always navigable, does give you some, it limits some of your running room there, I would say.
Wouldn't it seem to point toward a remedy being, as was suggested, to go to the legislature and ask for permission to sue to solve that problem on a state level rather than on an isolated section level?
The problem is that doesn't get done. The waiver in Brainerd took years to work that bill through the legislature, and no permission has been granted for this type of thing since that time on any river in Texas, and we know because we've tried. You cannot get it done. Therefore, the remedies that the state keeps telling us we have are either go out and sell the sand and gravel and sit there and wait for the state to come after you and then try to defend it, which these are ranching folks and tough-minded folks, but they're not willing to try that. And the option of going to the legislature is not working. So we are convinced that this position of ours, okay, as a takings claim must be recognized.
Okay, so what do you think would be the binding effect of a decision in a case like you described on the landowners up and down the stream bed? Have any precedential value or not?
In other words, if we went to trial in Donnelly County on the boundary dispute with the state arguing there's a river across your pasture this wide and us arguing there's not one at all, but if there is, it's only this wide. If that went to trial and you got an adjudication of that,
right.
I think on this record it would only apply to that section.
Well, how would the state... Can you try that case only on your pasture? Because the state says, the definition says from the mouth all the way up it has to be certain width, 30 feet as I recall.
I think that's a problem for the state.
So under the scenario we have here, every landowner in Texas who has something across their pasture, if the state has not, or if it's not determined it's navigable, the landowner sues the state to say, in my pasture, it's not navigable, and then the state would have to come in and defend that and effectively get into the burden of proving that entire stream or river is navigable from the mouth in every situation.
Well,
am I missing something on that?
Justice Johnson, I think practically, just from wrestling with that for years, I think what's going to happen tactically is you're going to end up with an application for a class action to bring in all these sections. And the state likes that a lot less than they do normally, the one section.
So then what we're talking about is a landowner who has a grievance, no question, has a grievance. It's difficult.
Yeah.
But that landowner sues the state in Donnelly County,
right,
and then someone down in Ector County, and then someone down in every other county sues, and pretty soon we have this, and in every one of those then, the state's going to turn into a class action, and the state's going to have to defend all these class actions. Seems like that might be the result that we're looking at here. If we follow your thing.
Well, that's possible. I have to acknowledge that. I think pragmatically that does not happen because, and a lot of that is just based on my experience in fighting the state in these river issues, is that typically the state tries to make it as small an argument as they can, so that you don't have a range war all up and down a river. And so it's my judgment that some of the imperatives of that sort of thing force the sorts of give and take that allows an adjudication of this particular tract that is not surprising to the state or the landowner. I see I'm out of time.
Are there any further questions?
How does the state handle wet weather creeks?
Wet weather creeks?
Yes.
Under Model versus Boyd and State versus Bradford, wet weather creeks are considered to be navigable waterways and are owned by the state. so long as they are an average of 30 feet from the mouth.
And how often does the stream have to flow? What if there's a major drought for 50 years and there's no water going through it?
I don't think we've ever answered that question. I mean, the only data points we have where it's been fully addressed and adjudicated are, at least to this court, our model and Bradford. But in each of those cases, the evidence showed that some seasonal rain in at least some years put water into the Rain Creek, and that was enough to establish that it was a navigable water course because the bed and the banks had the requisite statutory width. I'd like to make one quick point about the procedure before trying to give the court a little bit more comfort about how you measure these rivers, because I think that Mr. Sheets has tweaked the navigability jurisprudence in a way that's a little bit misleading. But to be clear, our position is that we shouldn't be rendering judgment in this case, saying that they can't bring a judgment against an official, because at this point, no official has been named. We think that we would win on a plea to the jurisdiction defending an official in his official capacity, but that's not an appropriate determination to make now. And this case is really about the legislature's choice about how to efficiently decide these navigability disputes. If the dispute is big enough, if there's a question all the way along the river, the Brainerd case shows that in that situation, the legislature is willing to go to the courts. But the legislature can also make the decision that it isn't important enough for these disputes to go into the courts, and that call is for the legislature to make.
It seems awfully harsh on a landowner. If they want to use property that, let's say it's clearly not navigable, they're stuck. There's nothing they can do, and the state can just say, we're not even going to answer that question. We may agree with you, but we're just going to stonewall you.
I do see daylight. The ultra-virus cause of action against an official can, in some circumstances, result in a favorable result for a plaintiff like the trust. The allegation would have to be that there's no reasonable basis to believe that the stream is navigable rather
what
than
what if the state just says, we don't know and we're not going to say? You had to get, they had to sue you in Donnelly County to and get the judge to call the state to get them out there, apparently. It's my
understanding that if they had picked up the phone and called the department would have gotten them an answer.
What if the department does say no, though? What does the landowner do in those circumstances? I mean, they could go out there and they could pick it up, but the government sometimes just says we're too busy to come where you are. What do they do?
Some of that's the cost of doing business in such a large state with fairly limited resources.
That's the state side. What does the landowner do?
The landowner can either commence operations and wait for regulation, or they can bring, I think that they are entitled in the course of the suit against the official to say, show us the money. Show us some basis
for
your...
Who would they sue if the state just said we're not going to come out? Which official would they sue?
They could sue, I'd say, any named appointed official at the department, for example.
What?
For a declaratory judgment that the department's assertion of control...
But the department's not asserting control. That's part of their complaint. The department, they finally got them to take position, but if a landowner, not this one, another landowner says we have a contract and the state says we're just not going to come out there, which official would they sue when all they said is we don't have time, we're not coming out? What could they sue them for?
If that were the case, I'm not really sure how that would actually happen. I mean, I'm having a hard time to understand how the department wouldn't respond in that situation, because I think they would.
But it doesn't really matter, because whatever they respond, good or bad, they could say we've been out there and they haven't. They could just say anything and there's nothing you can do about it as a landowner, right?
Well, no, you could, as a landowner, say that the department official asserted ownership and control on the basis of, let's just pick military conquest. That's obviously an invalid basis for asserting title and control. You can get an injunction to stop that.
Let's presume that they can come up with something. Let's presume that they can say, I spent 5 minutes, I looked at a map, I say it's navigable. I mean, a colorable basis, then there's nothing a landowner can do.
And I think the purpose of the ultra-virus lawsuit is to make sure that at least that happens. And that's right. There is no recourse unless they go to the legislature. Once again, that choice is the legislature's to make.
Any further questions?